Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to this August 29th edition of Vantage Point, a special two-hour edition of Vantage Point on WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network. That's the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. Today we will be talking about an update on the global reparations movement. The global reparations movement. We have an extraordinary lineup of guests for our conversation for today, and we want you to tune in. At the end of the, well, let me just give the lineup quickly. We're going to have Cam Howard joining us momentarily. Cam Howard is with Reparations United and much more. Dr. Joy DeGruy will be joining us, no stranger to this audience, the author of the Post-Traumatic Slavery Syndrome. Dr. Julius Garvey, global Pan-African icon, will be joining us. Don Rojas, former general manager of WBAI. James Early, again, no stranger to the Pacifica Network, one of the most brilliant analysts around. And a new voice, maybe, to this audience, Dr. Amara Enya, who is with Global Black and also a key strategist around reparations issues. That's going to be our lineup, 2 hours. But we're going to do a special thing here, too. This is a very, very special program, and we want to raise some funds, too, at the end of the show. I'd like to get raise at least $2,000. We know the station needs the resources. And so at the end of the show, for the last, we're going to invite you to call and give your perspectives and ask questions or share your views. But we also want you to support. I'd like to raise $2,000. I'd like to get 20 people at least to give, at least 20 people to give $100. I'll start it, as always, with my $100 pledge. And we'll roll from there and hope that we can get at least 20 people. The premium will be the show. I mean, WBAI supports reparations, has supported reparations. We've done some incredible programming on reparations, including some live broadcast of conferences and symposia. And so this conversation about reparations, which is exploding throughout the world, is one that you do not want to miss. And so we're going to invite you to make your pledge. Of course, people know the number to call. Actually, I got to find the number here. I got a different sheet in front of me, but I'll be able to find it momentarily to give you the number that you are to call into in order to make your pledge. I have a different run of show today, and therefore I didn't have that sheet right in front of me. But we'll be talking about really, really, really the extraordinary development of the global reparations movement and how it is developing in these United States of America. And so we're now waiting for our first guest, Cam Howard, to join us. And as soon as he's ready to roll, we're going to be ready to roll. We have a lot to talk about. Again, very, very exciting conferences that have come up. I participated in many of those. A summit in Bellagio, Italy, an action at the Vatican, a major summit in Accra, Ghana. Don Rojas went off to Colombia for the inauguration of the new president and vice president. James Early is going to tell us about developments that are happening in Cuba, as Cuba has come on strong, embracing reparations. And indeed, beyond that, the prospect of Lula becoming president again in Brazil. This is one of the most important moments in the history of the reparations movement. We're now joined by Cam Howard. Cam Howard is someone that I'm kind of joined at the hip at these days. Of course, you've heard him here before. He's a former male co-chair in COBRA, but now has his own organization that he's building out very magnificently called Reparations United. Cam Howard, welcome again to Vantage Point.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels. And yes, we are joined at the hip these days.
All right. Before we discuss the Bellagio summit and the Vatican action, would you say a word about the organization that you're building, the mission of Reparations United?
Yeah, Reparations United. We look at, all this tremendous energy right now in America in regards to local reparations on the state and local levels. And there are many injuries that we share across this country in various cities. We're dealing with the same issues of injury, for instance, crime and lack of graduation of our children, education of our children. And what Reparations United tries to do is link some of these communities together, take advantage of, you know, the minds that we have across the country, and create reparation solutions at the local level. In addition, we look at how we can fund local reparations, particularly looking at the institutions and corporations that exist in some of our communities around the country that have engaged in some of the complicit harms against our people, and create a mechanism where we can all collectively go after some of these resources.
All right. Well, you helped to give, you've given updates on H.R. 40 and a lot of other things that we've been involved in. Evanston, this is such an amazing moment. The Bellagio Summit, the Vatican Action, the Accra Summit. You played an instrumental role in all of them. But I want you to speak specifically to Bellagio and the Vatican, beginning with acquainting our audience with what was the Bellagio Summit, and how did it come about?
Well, the Bellagio Summit was a summit of activist scholars and healers in looking at the issue of reparations and racial healing. It came about as a result of initially a cohort of reparations activists had received a grant from the MacArthur Foundation, and one of those grantees was Nicole Hannah-Jones, who, of course, is the author of the 1619 Project. In addition to getting a MacArthur grant, she also got a grant from Rockefeller and a fellowship with the Rockefeller Foundation at the Bellagio Institute in Italy. And she elected to invite some of the MacArthur grantees to Bellagio to take a deeper dive into this whole issue of reparations and racial healing, bringing together groups from the cohort, bringing together people from the continent and some others who she brought in, bringing together some funders, bringing upon some of the allies that have been aiding us in this effort of global reparations. And so we assembled in Bellagio and looked at some very important issues, how to move the reparations movement forward.
And what do you see as some of, there were many, 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 many. It was just an extraordinary meeting. I mean, I'm overusing this word, and I don't do it in any hyperbolic way, because it's just amazing what's happening these days. I know you can't share everything, but are there a couple of sort of major takeaways from Bellagio that you'd like to share?
Sure. What I found that was really great is that we determined we would create a unified framework in which to develop a demand and reparations, not only here in America, but as we move forward. We looked at how the African nations who were complicit in some of the selling of Africans, how we would have that frame that discussion, one around bringing us all closer together in unity, as opposed to blaming one group or another. Right. We looked at how we would deal with some of these international entities like the UN, the IMF, and the World Bank, and other institutions of, that have continued these crimes, this systematic injuries that we suffer from in this country. We looked at how we could better move the discussion here in America around H.R. 40, around the executive order, and that nature. So there was a lot of things that were discussed, and it was a very important gathering.
Yeah, it was really, really, really important. Well, you have the distinction of being the architect of what I think is destined to be one of the most important reparations initiatives of our era. And our planning for going to Bellagio, and Bellagio, by the way, is in the northern part of the country near Milan, about maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours from Milan. And you said to our planning group, we cannot go to Italy and not find a way to go to Rome and do some kind of action at the Vatican. That was your leadership coming forward on this very vital issue. So I want you just to speak about the whole issue of the Vatican action. I know why you did it. Our audience may not know, so I don't ever want to take anything for granted. So what was your thinking about the importance of conducting an action at the Vatican?
Well, as you stated, Dr. Daniels, I said there's no way we can go to Italy as reparation activists. I mean, we can go there as tourists or whatever, but there's no way we can go to Italy as reparations activists having this deep discussion around reparations globally for people of African descent and Africans and not go to the Vatican. And the reason for that is because it was the Vatican in the 1400s who pretty much ordered, first to Portugal and then to Spain, ordered these European governments to go into the continent of Africa, destroy their kingdoms, plunder all of their resources and riches, and commit their progeny to perpetual enslavement. That went on, you know, through a series of papal bulls for over a century and a half, and then became known as the effect of that became known as the transatlantic slave trade. So there could not have been a transatlantic slave trade if it was not for the ordering, condoning, the blessing, the declaration by the Roman Catholic Church to engage in this type of criminal activity on the African world. And so I was very delighted that the group, which is now being called the Global Circle of Reparations and Healing, said, yes, we do need to go to the Vatican and asked me to take the lead. And we initially began to just put together what I call a reparations presentment. And the reparations presentment is something that I had developed in 2016. I used the legal criminal law definition of a presentment and the commercial law definition of presentment, put them both together and created what is called a reparations presentment. And basically what it does is lays out a formal document of the harms or offenses created by someone or crimes created. It lays out, a reparations presentment lays out the injuries that has resulted and also lays out the repair or the claim that we have as a result of those offenses, those crimes that were created. And so we assembled a team, Dr. Nola Aird of the Community Healing Network and I, began writing this presentment, and subsequently we got input from Nicole Hannah Jones and others in the cohort. But it was a very important document. It's a powerful document. And we delivered it to the Pope. I mean, well, we delivered it to the Vatican. We met with the Pontifical Council, Secretary of the Pontifical Council of Culture and Education, which is a very important organization within the Vatican, and he has agreed to make sure it gets into the right hands.
And that was what, again, what was so interesting. When we first started off, we didn't really know what we were going to do. We thought maybe we would just be out there with some picket signs. But we did meet with Bishop Tai. And just quickly, we didn't know how that meeting was going to go. You know, would they be polite and just sort of sit and listen to us and then dismiss us? But we were pleasantly surprised. How did that meeting go?
Well, it was a great meeting as far as, you know, our expectations. It exceeded our expectations. As you say, we didn't know how it was going to go, but he was very welcoming. He offered an idea of how his particular council could assist us. He gave us some thoughts around how to move forward through the Vatican structure, and he agreed to assist us going forward. And he gave us a few contacts within the African world that we can pursue. So it was very, very great meeting. But he hadn't read the presentment prior to the meeting, and so we wanted to know what his thoughts were after reading the presentment. And we did get the very first comment from him, and that is that we raised some very serious historical, moral, and legal issues,
right,
that he would be determining which offices and policies within the Vatican would be necessary for those to be fleshed out in great detail. So they're going to be assembling some of the greatest minds in the Vatican to address the issues that we raised. And so that's where we're at. We're starting to assemble our team of experts from around the country as well. And that's a process. We're translating the presentment in French and Spanish and Portuguese and in Italian. And that'll be coming out probably around the 20th of September, somewhere around that time. And also we'll be planning some teach-ins around the presentment globally as well.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about next, and you have anticipated my question, letting people know where it is, because this is a huge, huge initiative. And I know as I've been presenting it, there are people who want to be a part of it. We have a commissioner, Reverend Dr. Turner, Robert Turner, who has, and he's eager to become a part of it. It's not just faith leaders, but there are some faith leaders. I was having a conversation. You have participated in the Pan-African Unity Dialogue. Reverend Dennis Dillon, when I made my report, he was eager to say, well, wait a minute, you know, how do we get engaged? We want to be a part of this. So I'm sure that there are going to be faith leaders in addition to scholars and activists who are going to want to become a part. So if people want to become a part, well, two questions. One is, if they want to become a part, how do they engage? And number two, I really want people to see this presentment. It is an incredible document. It is a historic document. So we want to be able to give people information about if they want to join or become a part, how do they do that? And secondly, you know, how do people get a copy, or are they able to go and read the presentment?
Sure. So right now we're building out, this is an action that's coming out of, the MacArthur cohort, which we officially call ourselves now the Global Circle of Reparations and Healing. And we're building out our website. So everything will be on our website. But until then, you can go to IBW21.org and search the Vatican Action, and you'll get a copy of our press release detailing the success of the meeting. And in that press release, it's embedded a link to actually get the official presentment, and you can read it. Also, to join on right now, you would just have to send me an email, Cam Howard. You would send it to cam@reparationsunited.org. And that's, again, cam@reparationsunited.org. We're compiling our list right now of not only, as you say, faith leaders, Dr. Daniels, but as, you know, Bishop Tai accurately pointed out, that we raised some significant historical, moral, and legal issues. So we need scholars, historical scholars. We need the moral experts, the legal experts, the faith leaders who have a tremendous acumen around faith and moral issues. And also we need legal scholars as well. So that's the three areas of dominance that we'll be assembling our team or teams to address this very, very historical and collective enemy, shared entity that has came to capitalize on the harms created against our people.
And once again, the people can, is it CAM? I don't want to correct me if I'm wrong. It's CAM@reparationsunited.org?
That's correct.
All right, CAM@reparationsunited.org, audience. That's how you can, if you want to become involved in various ways, we're aggregating people by interests and various areas that they're interested in. And of course, you can go see the actual presentment on the IBW website at IBW21.org, and just put in the Vatican Action, and you will see, and incredible photos, by the way, too, from this action. Cam Howard, appreciate you so much. We are joined at the hip doing this work, and I am delighted to be so as we go down the road. The reparations movement, you know, people that you've worked with, Dr. Conrad World and others, they, Hannibal Afrik and Queen Mother Moore, they are dancing because of the work that you're doing and the movement of the reparations movement. So honored to be working with you, and we look forward to continue this collaboration.
Thank you so much, Dr. Daniels. Thank you for mentoring also in this process. Really appreciate it.
All right. Okay. That's our first guest, Cam Howard. And this, I'm telling you, audience, the reparations movement is exploding. We referenced the Accra Reparations Summit. And Cam has played a leading role in that as well, but I wanted him specifically to talk about Bellagio and the Vatican Action, because he is going to be spearheading the leadership on the Vatican Action. But we have two guests who are going to address the issue of the Accra Summit, one of which is absolutely no stranger to the WBAA audience. I actually had to pre-record her because she is so incredibly busy, but it was a joy to be connected with Dr. Joy DeGruy. And in fact, you'll hear me talk about the fact that y'all almost ran me off the air one time because I mispronounced her name. But we now want to hear from our dear beloved sister, Dr. Joy DeGruy. Well, we're talking to none other than Dr. Joy DeGruy, and you know she is a favorite with the WBAA audience. In fact, I told her the story that one time I mispronounced her name, and I thought they were going to run me off the air on WBAI, but I have recovered. Anyway, Dr. Joy, you played such an incredible role in so much that we've done, from Bellagio to Accra and beyond, but specifically as it relates to Accra. I'd like you to share with the audience what your role was at the Accra Summit.
My role at Accra was to bring in the healing component in connection with reparations. Sometimes they're separated, but what has happened, especially at Accra, was understanding the fact that these things have to coexist and they have to happen simultaneously, the healing and the reparations, which are connected to each other.
And how was that received in terms of your presentations and your role in Accra?
Well, it was too short.
It sure was. I remember that.
aside from that, I think it people, let me just say this, that I learned something, and what people learn is we don't know about each other. In our global Black community, you know, we know that here in the United States, they're trying to shut us down. Everything what we did have, which wasn't much, they try to get rid of that. And so we not only do we need to learn our own history here in America as African Americans, we also need to learn what has happened on the continent and what colonialism did. And so I think what happened and what I was able to do is bridge that to say, let me tell you what's happening in our neck of the woods. And let me talk about how that fits with who you are and how we all globally move through the world.
And I can tell you, people, it was well received. In fact, we ran out of time. They was demanding more time. It was like, Joy, Joy. I mean, it was absolutely phenomenal in terms of the kinds of relationships that were being forged. And this has been an interesting journey in general in terms of that. And I wondered whether you would speak to some of the kind of relationships you've built with people, some of them whom we were planning virtually, we never had ever seen before until we touched down in Accra.
I have to honestly say, and this was my second time in Ghana, and I just was humbled. I was humbled, one, to know that my work reached across to the continent.
That's
and
right.
That folks, you know, were aware of my work, using my work, utilizing it for healing, specifically for healing. It was a profound experience. And I think that what I learned, the people that I met were just brilliant. I mean, that's not a surprise, but brilliant and approachable.
Yes.
Brilliant and right there with us.
Right.
Could be on the ground. It could be standing next to the president. You know what I'm saying? All of that in between. And I just really felt confirmed. And I felt like for the very first time, Africa had my back.
Right. All right. All right. Well, one of the relationships I know that we're going to talk to him later, I know he was excited. Dr. Julius Garvey, he was excited about meeting Dr. Joy DeGruy. And while y'all did not sort of formally have a presentation, y'all got a chance to exchange with each other and talk with each other. And I'm just wondering, what was it like for two icons like yourself to have an exchange? And what was that like to talk to Dr.
First of all, I didn't put myself in the icon room.
I did. You don't have to.
Okay. That ain't the same thing going on there. What I just really felt and what I got was a humble posture, yet at the same time, this very powerful, it's like, you know, oh, this very, very powerful mind and spirit and energy. And it just, it's inspiring. I mean, I just felt totally inspired. And at the same time, you know, don't mess around and not do what you're supposed to do. Okay.
right.
There's that part of it, because we have expectations of you. And I think there, it just is really realizing we're in really good hands. We're in good hands.
You know, and he spoke to, because he heard your presentation and he was just attracted, because he said, because he had always been saying, I've heard him say this before, what's missing, he said, is that healing psychological component. And he has said that that component, and when he saw you and what the work that you were doing, he was just ecstatic in terms of making that connection. And he's talked about it even after, as I'm sure he's going to share even more of that. So it was a great connection. And I'm sure the two of you are going to be like working with, because he spelled out this whole concept of African humanism.
That's right.
A completely way that we live and what we're about. And we were just sharing and talking about that in terms of some of the issues facing our community, how we have to reconnect with ourselves and our own history and moving forward. Well, let me say this, in terms of this incredible summit, the Accra Summit, as you're moving forward, talk about how it's going to impact your work, or will impact your work moving forward, because none of us left Accra the same as we went into Accra.
No, that is correct. I think for me, first of all, I have got to, and this is a difficulty with writing anything, you know, at almost the moment it goes into print, it's, you know, it's out of date. And what I realize is, while my book Post-Traumatic is certainly not out of date, but what I need to do is update it. And having had this experience in Accra and in Bellagio, there's a whole nother level of learning that we have to bring in, because as you've said, and as my brother also said in this, in terms of looking at our responsibilities here and how we move forward with this process of psychological healing, we've got to appreciate that as we build upon the need for reparations, you got to have folks able to hold it, able to receive it, able to understand it, embrace it, and articulate it. And this is the folks on the ground. Right. And I'm really glad, because we tend to talk to the talking heads and the suits, but we've got to get to everybody. And I think that was the point of coming together, where we got to have the right hand and the left hand knowing what's going on. Right. And so for me, I think moving forward, it's going to inform my work, but also continue to make that connection with the continent.
Yeah, and I heard you talk about that. You talked about the need for it right at the grassroots level, building out that grassroots level so that the consciousness will permeate, as you said, all the way down. So now you talked about revising and whatever your extraordinary book. I mean, it took the world by storm. So now, when is it coming out, and how
do
people get in touch with you?
I'm actually currently revising the book, but I'm also, part of the reason why I'm revising the book is I have a study guide, right? But now I have models that I've been using all this time that are evidence-based and working. Okay, they work. But what I've not done is I've never felt comfortable putting the models in the study guide, because I can't be certain and sure that people understand the nature of the injury before they start going in trying to help. Right. So I'm very careful about that. So, but now I can begin to fold in what we learned,
right.
What we learned, because we talk to the people. In other words, we are co-collaborators in our healing. We're co-contributors to the improvement that we're all trying to create. And so what I'm going to put into the study guide, which I'm going to marry very closely, much closer to the book, is that idea of how do we move into this process of healing now that we understand the full nature of the injury. Now we can start talking about how we, one, stop further injury, because they still, you know, injuring us, and how we protect our children and change that trajectory to one that is an ongoing, improving, sustainable way of living.
So, and we can expect it to be out when?
Oh, come on now. Give me a break. I just got home. First of all, let me just be real clear. I'm going fishing. Okay. I'm getting ready to take some time and go fishing.
Okay, now, by the way, we're going to hook up on that because, you know, that's one of my favorite hobbies is fishing.
Oh, no, don't even go there.
Yes, we're going to do that. But I know it may be 6 months. It may be a year. I just want the audience to know.
No, it'll definitely be.
Well, I know because people are going to have tremendous.
No. It'll be within 6 months for sure.
Right. And is there a way that people can get in touch with your organization so that they're constantly?
Absolutely. I have two organizations that I've worked with. One, I've developed a private nonprofit, which is called Be the Healing. .com. So Be the Healing is really committed to all of this work in terms of how we now integrate what we've learned into a method and approach and a strategy to healing on a community level. So that's something that is the Be the Healing. That's my private nonprofit. But if you go to joydegrew.com, which is Joy DeGruy Publications, which is my professional private arm, for profit. So you'll be able to access both, but eventually they'll be very separated. You know, there's already a separate website for it. So that's what's happening. And you'll know about that. I'll put it out there and I'll probably do a little podcast or something talking about the book and what's happening.
Well, you know, you got to come back to WBI when you do that because you got a huge fan base.
Oh, no, not on. Let me tell you, WBI had my back in the very beginning when they was coming after me. Yeah, I said, oh, no,
we got it.
So I owe a debt of literally having left the university, all the stuff that I did. They lifted me and held me through that entire process. So I always show up.
All right, to our listening audience, you heard it right here on WBI 99.5 as we talk about the global reparations movement and the status and the role of Dr. Joy DeGruy. And she says she's coming back. So we appreciate you so much spending time with us.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, what Dr. Joy is, what a joy. And again, her contribution is immense. And she is so... She was so thankful and thankful for the support, really, that WBAI supported, that provided for her. And you heard her, you know, talk about that. So, you know, whenever the book comes out, the revised version, we're going to get first dibs. And we're going to do a special right here on WBAI with the blessing of the general manager and the program director. Well, we heard a conversation referencing one of the great global Pan-African icons of our time, a medical professional, but also someone who just happens to be the son of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. And of course, we're in the month of the celebration of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. He has been very credible and strong in helping to foster and present his father's legacy. And he has developed this concept of African humanism, and he presented, you know, at Accra. But also, again, this interface with Dr. Joy DeGruy was also important. So we now welcome to our microphones once again at WBAI, Dr. Julius Garvey. Dr. Garvey, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you so much, Ron. It's good to be with you. And, you know, I was privileged to be in Accra. In terms of the conference on reparations and racial healing. And I was also privileged to really listen to Dr. Joy DeGruy and actually discuss with her
right.
the perspective of what she's written about, post-traumatic sleep syndrome. And it's not just America's legacy of enduring injury and healing, but it's Europe's legacy of enduring injury and healing, because it's not just American in terms of it involving and harming African Americans. It's a global problem. And,
right.
I'm glad to hear that she has an ongoing program, Be the Healing, because that's what's necessary in terms of repair. What it is that we are repairing? We have to repair ourselves, and there's so much psychological trauma that it's important for us to have a methodology of how we heal ourselves. And,
right.
We've been working with Linda James Myers, who, as many of you know, she's been out there in terms of her introduction, shall we say, to what she calls an optimal psychology. And that's very much an Afrocentric perspective on how we who we are as humans and how we function within the world in terms of society and civilization. So I think, Ron, it's going to be important for us as we go down the road to pull together, you know, people such as Dr. DeGroo, people such as Linda James Myers, people such as Wade Noble, et cetera, to bring about that understanding of the psychological damage as well as the methodology of healing. Because right. if we don't heal ourselves, then we cannot really prosper or thrive in the future. And, right. and we cannot really construct the future. That's important for, you know, our coming generations. Right. So that's one thing I just wanted to say. And the other thing we did mention a lot about education at that particular time. And in terms of recovering identity, you know, those are the two things, the destruction of our self-identity as people. And that has to do also with destruction of our history. And as my dad said, a people without the knowledge of their past history and culture is like a tree without roots. And that's one of our, that's the other aspect of our problem in terms of identity. We need to know our history and our traditions. And of course, you know, we have a number of people who have helped us in that direction, people such as Van Sertima, John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben, and we can go, you know, on and on. And of course, most recently, we had Robin Walker, who came out with his wonderful book, When We Ruled. So we have that ability to really create what I would call a global, you know, African educational program. You know, we work with Joyce King, and I know you know Joyce.
Oh, yes.
She's written a lot on Black education. She's a professor in the educational field.
Georgia State University.
She's very
yes.
experienced. And we need to develop that. Robin Walker, of course, is in England. So we have this, you know, global perspective. We can bring these scholars together to develop that sort of curriculum. You know, as you know, we have people such as Mother Fiasante, we have Maulana Karenga, et cetera, who are globalists and understand our global history as well as our global culture. So right. these are things I think that we have to do in terms of repairing ourselves, in terms of our identity and who we are. Because, right. you know, you mentioned, you know, that I favor African humanism. That's the next paradigm. And it is the civilization paradigm of African people. It's not materialism. It's not scientific materialism. It's not individualism, which is what the Europeans have put forward. And they have done great wonders in terms of industrialization. But you can see that it doesn't solve the problems of people because it's perpetuated war and conflict, you know, over and over. World War One, World War Two, Korean War, you know, Afghanistan, Vietnamese War, et cetera, et cetera. And ongoing wars now, Ukraine and Russia and NATO bombing Libya, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's not able to solve problems. It's not able to live in peace. It doesn't really have a true civilization because civilization is about humanizing people within society. It's not been able to do that. So we need a new paradigm. And the new paradigm, right. of course, is African humanism. So right. I think we need those two legs to walk on and identify as things that we have to promote in terms of our repairing ourselves, irrespective right. of the relationship with others. This is what we have to do for ourselves.
Right. And Dr. Garvey, it was, let me contextualize it for our audience, because you were on a panel in which you were providing a critique of these global white supremacist capitalist systems. And it was in that context that you presented, you know, the notion of African humanism, the alternative with the sense of Maat, going back to ancient Kemet and the notions of, you know, spirituality and a sense of human centeredness, which has been a part of the traditional African way of life for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And of course it was well received, and then connecting that with the healing concept. And by the way, you know, Wade Nobles and people like that, you know, the Dr. Enola Aird is with the Community Healing Network, the Association of Black Psychologists. They're all working mm-hmm. together along with Dr. Joy DeGruy in building out this healing, this African mm-hmm. This African-centered healing methodology. Let me just mm-hmm. ask you, you have, I visited Ghana with you in 2019 with Reverend Dennis Dillon, the door of return. You had an opportunity to meet privately with the president of Ghana. You have developed a relationship with him. And, of course, we had an opportunity to meet with him, and he delivered a rousing endorsement of reparations. And I'm wondering whether you would conclude by just indicating how important is it, or how do you assess the importance of President Adu's endorsement of reparations?
Well, I think it's critical, you know, because as you know, the destruction of the process of enslavement as well as colonialism affected Africans, not only those of us who were transferred to the diaspora, but Africans on the continent. It derailed the internal development of the continent itself. And as you know, certainly the boundaries that were placed there in 1884, 1885 at the Berlin Conference, those are boundaries that cut across nations, that cut across tribes, and it has continued to be problematic, shall we say, for the unification of Africa and for Africa to present itself really as a geopolitical entity and as a civilization. So the trauma is still there and it's still functioning. And we see, for example, right now in Ethiopia with the Tigray civil war, and we see it in Nigeria with a sort of tripartite. We see it in Cameroons with the Anglo and the Francophone section. We see France still a major colonial power, you know, within Africa, stealing its gold, stealing all of its wealth. So it's ongoing. And definitely we have to get the Africans on board in terms of a concerted effort to bring about resistance to the hegemony of Europe and America. And, you know, right. I think we can see what NATO has been doing. It was NATO that destroyed Libya. It's NATO that is fighting a proxy war in Ukraine against Russia, again for the hegemony of the West over the whole world in terms of its globalization perspective. So we have to unite, and we have to come together with the understanding that we're still in the in manifestation of neocolonialism. Globalization is neocolonialism. They're still stealing our resources, human and otherwise, and minerals and agriculture to benefit Europe, Europeans and Americans and so on. So this has to stop. And we have to stand together with our diaspora as the sixth region, you know, because we do represent, you know, more than 300 million people. So it's not just us in the diaspora. It's a united front that's necessary.
Right.
And that was a major statement in that direction.
Right. All right. Well, Dr. Julius Garvey, we'll be working together. I call you my president general. I'm just a plebe and a corporal in the Army. So we'll be hanging out together with Professor Beckles and others working.
You know, he took over everything.
Working down the line. Appreciate being in your presence and your commitment and your work. And you have represented your father so well, but not just representing, you in your own right have developed and expanded on his fundamental ideas and articulating them in a way that increasingly people are gravitating to. And as you said in another recent presentation, it is him manifested in the whirlwind and in the storm. That is one of my favorite quotations. So thank you so much for the work that you do.
And thank you, Ron, for all the work that you do. And I'm very pleased to work with you.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, this global reparations movement is global in scope. I'm pleased that the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and the National African American Reparations Commission through both of these bodies, but particularly through NARC, the National African American Reparations Commission, we've developed these extraordinary relationships with the CARICOM Reparations Commission, now with the African Union's transitional fund, and we had already developed relationships, deep relationships, by way of a delegation that Danny Glover and James Early organized to Colombia a few years ago at the invitation of Dr. Esther Ojulari, with whom we had an interface in New Orleans at a reparations gathering. And it was there that we really began to connect with some of the reparations organizers and activists and built out a strong relationship. Fast forward the tape. And we have this these significant developments in Colombia, which will also contribute mightily to the growth and development, the consolidation and the expansion of the global reparations movement. And we were honored that Don Rojas, former general manager of WBAI, former, of course, the press secretary for Maurice Bishop, and indeed the director of communications and international relations for the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, accepted an invitation to actually go to Colombia for the inauguration. And so we've had a conversation with Don Rojas, and we want to now share our conversation with Don Rojas in terms of his perspective on the significance of the recent elections in Colombia.
We're delighted to be joined by Don Rojas, who is no stranger to the WBAI audience. He is, of course, the former general manager at WBAI and, of course, Free Speech Radio and a bunch of other things that he's accomplished. And we want to get his take on the significance of the victory of the administration in Colombia. So welcome, Don Rojas. But at least we take for granted that our audience understands what we're talking about. Would you please bring people up to speed about what just happened in Colombia and a bit about its significance?
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Dr. D, and good afternoon to the rest of the panelists, and also a good afternoon to our WBAI listeners out there. It's always good to be back on the airwaves of 99.5 FM. Yes, the 2 months ago, a major change of government took place in Colombia, one of the most significant Latin American countries, both in terms of its size and its geopolitical role that it has played for many, many years in the overall politics of the Latin American region and, by extension, even of the Western Hemisphere. A progressive, left-leaning government came to power for the very first time in the history of the country, led by a former guerrilla who fought, or at least was involved, in the ongoing war in Colombia that has been waged for many, many years between a guerrilla movement and the governments, various governments, conservative governments, supported by right-wing paramilitia groups in Colombia. So for the first time in the history of that country, the people elected a progressive government led by Gustavo Petro, the new president, and vice president. The very first time an Afro-Colombian woman had been elected to such a high office, political office in the country. So she is a very well-known environmental activist. She has a global reputation, has in fact been awarded several distinguished international awards for her work in advocating for climate change in Colombia. And she's also, of course, for many, many years, been involved in advocating for reparations for the Afro-Colombian population of that country, which, by the way, is a substantial size population of Black people in Colombia. It's estimated that close to 10 million of Colombia's population of a little over 50 million Afro-descendants. They're mostly concentrated on the Caribbean coastline in the northern part of Colombia and also on the Pacific coastline. Colombia has a distinction of being the only Latin American country, South American country, that is, with a coastline on both the Pacific and the Caribbean Sea.
Right.
In terms of the Caribbean part of Colombia, the city that's in that part of the country has been for during the slave trade, during the transatlantic slave trade, a major slave trading port in that part of the country.
Right.
So for all of those reasons,
very significant. Let me just ask you about your role, because we get the significance. This is a huge victory for the progressive forces, but you played a specific role in the inauguration. Particularly as it relates to our subject of reparations. Would you please share that with our audience?
Yes, we'd be happy to do so. I had the distinction and the honor of representing both the Institute of the Black World, 21st Century, and the National African American Reparations Commission, NARC, invited by the new government of Colombia to the inauguration of the new president and vice president, which took place on August the 7th. And the day before, there was a very significant international reparations conference that was held in Bogota, and I had the honor of making the keynote presentation to that conference, in which I kind of scanned the globe for and gave an updated report on the reparations movements as they are emerging and evolving. In North America, in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Europe, and now, of course, more and more in Latin America. That conference was significant in the sense that it was the very first international reparations conference to be held anywhere in Latin America, with participants coming from several countries in the South American continent, including Brazil, Uruguay, Chile, and other countries in Latin America, as well as the Caribbean. The Caribbean was represented by one of the co-chairs of the CARICOM Reparations Commission, Brother Phillips, and he's also the head of the Guyana Reparations Committee. Guyana also sent its prime minister to the inauguration. The inauguration ceremony, Dr. D, was really very impressive.
Wow.
In terms of pomp and splendor and so on. But there are two things I want to share with our WBI listeners that I found particularly striking. One was when the new president was being sworn in and he was taking his oath of office, he rested his hand on an encased sword that was used by Simon Bolivar in the liberation of Colombia.
Oh, wow, man, that was great.
It was fantastic. And also they showed video clips of the day before the inauguration of him being spiritually cleansed by a number of native chiefs in Colombia. There is a fairly substantial indigenous population in that country, of indigenous people, and the chiefs got together to perform a cleansing ceremony for the president. It was amazing. Talking about the indigenous peoples, they too, by the way, were very well represented at this reparations conference on August the 6th, and they are going to be playing a fairly substantial role moving forward as the country shapes its own reparations program.
Right. And I understand the vice president herself actually came and visited the summit?
Yes, she came at the very end. It was the highlight of the summit, as a matter of fact. She came with a small delegation and, of course, a very substantial delegation of, her security detail. Which is a reflection, of course, of how precarious the situation is for both the president and vice president in the context of a continuing war being waged against against the progressive forces by right-wing militia. In fact, just a few days ago, the president escaped with his life an attempted assassination plot. A shootout, actually, that took place on a road, a rural road. He was visiting a province in Colombia on the border of Venezuela, close to the Venezuelan border, when this attack took place. But fortunately, he survived. The native peoples are going to be well represented in the plan. Now, the plan, which is interesting, the plan that we were told is going to involve reparations is going to be housed in the vice president's own ministry. She'll have a portfolio of they're going to create a new ministry, a ministry of equality, which will be housed in the vice president's office, and with a portfolio for reparations, which will be very well funded. So they are, they're serious about creating a state-led, state-sponsored reparations program for the country of Colombia. And of course, they also want very much to reach out and build collaborative relations with reparations groups around the world. The vice president, in her remarks at the end of the conference, made it very clear that they want to establish relations with the CARICOM Reparations Commission and also with the National African American Reparations Commission, as well as reparations activists around the world. So they seem to be extremely serious about the issue of reparations. And
well, what an extraordinary report! And I must say, it was really an honor to have you as the Director of Communications and International Relations for the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, and on an equivalent basis, also representing NARC, given your history of work in the Caribbean, your relationship with the CARICOM Reparations Commission and the Secretariat, and the relationships that we built with people like Dr. Esther Ojolari, whom we had as a guest a few weeks ago here on WBAI, to be there representing us. And boy, it sounds like it was really exhilarating. It was one of those great, powerful moments of celebration after years and years and years of brutal, and in some ways almost genocidal struggle against attacks against the indigenous community and Afro-descendants community. But it's one of those moments that you see triumph in terms of the surging movement in general, but also the surging reparations movement.
Absolutely. And to the WBI listeners, mark this name, memorize it. Francia Marquez Mina. Francia Marquez Mina.
Right.
She is the new Afro-Colombian vice president of Colombia. She's a trained lawyer, in addition to being an outstanding environmental activist. She is a very impressive and very charismatic person. And hopefully our BI listeners will get an opportunity to maybe see her in person in the not too distant future. But keep track of what's happening in Colombia as a whole, and more particularly in terms of their reparations program.
Well, thank you for your report. We certainly are going to be working on building that relationship with the new vice president. All right, we're now going to shift our attention to another one of our incredible guests who has been with us for many, many years. No stranger again to the WBAI audience. We're gonna shift now to our discussion with James Early.
So, James Early, welcome to Vantage Point once again.
Thank you. Good to be with you. Good to listen to this very informative program.
Well, James, you are an incredible analyst. You've been doing this work for so long. I'm not trying to date you because you're still vibrant and strong and doing a great work, but you've been doing this work a long time. And by this work, I mean you and Danny Glover and others. This work of having us to understand the role of Afro descendants in the hemisphere and working on the ground with Afro descendant communities throughout Central and South America to help them achieve their voice and empowerment. So you just bring so much to the table. This remarkable development in Colombia. There's remarkable developments in Cuba and Brazil. We just heard Don Rojas, talk about the developments in the election that just took place in Colombia. But I also want you to just comment on Colombia. I mean, how? Because again, this is. He described it, but I'd like your own take on just what you see in relationship to what has developed in Colombia after so many years of struggle?
Well, this is a very significant development. Certainly, it has been proclaimed as historic, and of course, the personhood of an Afro-Colombian woman as the vice president is extraordinarily significant, both from the vantage point of history and from the vantage point of gender discrimination concentrated in the discrimination against Afro-descendants and indigenous women, and of course, Euro-Colombian working women as well. But beyond that context, I think it's important to look at the role of Colombia in the hemisphere. Colombia is the home of at least 7 U.S. military bases. It is the largest cocaine producer. Billions of dollars from taxpayers in the United States have gone into upholding a very elite, corrupt, racist, violent group of presidents in Colombia. And so in this context, the struggle for democracy is not just being able to vote, but being able to get results. Colombia perhaps presents the most complex of the Afro-descended communities in one respect across our Americas, in that you've got Raizales, Palenqueros, and then just Afro-Colombians in general. Those distinctions are both cultural, linguistic, and they also happen to deal with issues of collective land versus individual interests of Afro-descendants. So the issue of reparations will manifest in a different kind of construct beyond the commonality of African descent identity and the struggle against racism. And we have to keep in context that the United States uses, and this is bipartisan, both Democrats and Republicans, uses Colombia as a spear into the heart of South America. It has a very dramatic history of violence with the CIA and the like. And so in this context, Afro-Colombians will be struggling to improve their lives, but it is a question of political power. Not only improving their lives, they've got to actually move the country forward. So that's how I think we need to look at the issue of Colombia today. Lastly, I would say that Colombia has been far ahead of most of Latin American and even Caribbean countries over the years in stepping forward on looking at issues of racial discrimination and making certain pronouncements and apologies, educating a large number of Afro-Colombians. And so this is just another step in a long process of grassroots organizing, which Francia Marquez really is a great example of, being in communities across the country, rural and urban, and organizing, not from a formal political elite class or a upper black class, as we have seen in some instances where there have been other elected officials here in the United States, and in at least one other case of an Afro-descent woman in Central America who comes from the black community, but did not have the sort of potential that I think we will see coming out of Colombia.
James, recently, within the last couple of weeks, I think it was the foreign minister, I may be wrong and you'll correct me, from Cuba, made an extraordinary pronouncement or decree, a proclamation endorsing reparatory justice for Afro-descendants throughout the hemisphere. I may be mischaracterizing it. I know you know exactly what it is. Would you talk about that? And then just to say, how significant is this pronouncement?
Well, this pronouncement came from Bruno Rodriguez, the foreign ministry minister of Cuba, who has stepped forward with a very strong statement about the struggle against racism inside Cuban socialism. There are a couple of things here, and he's an extraordinary person in terms of his statecraft, but he has been literally pushed. I recall Danny Glover and I meeting with him several years ago when he was not at this point. In fact, he was well behind this point. So what is given motive to this? It is the organization of Afro-Cuban patriots in the context of Cuban socialism who have fought the battle to push the Communist Party of Cuba and the government of Cuba to move forward on the issues of racial discrimination, both as a heritage factor that comes from the hundreds of years of racialized capitalism and colonialism, but also which is reproduced in contemporary terms of, we have to realize one important factor. Most of the people who left Cuba after the revolution were not black. Most of the people who stayed were black and mestizo, as the late Esteban Morales would describe them. Therein, when people are sending back remittances, sending money home to families, not with intent to discriminate, it actually then reproduces a discriminatory pattern objectively that the government, in its nationalist perspective, simply having said in the past that we are just all Cubans, was not taking cognition of. Organized, particularly artists and intellectuals through the Union of Artists and Writers, pushed and led around the issue of racial discrimination at cultural levels, indicating that African history was not being taught in the schools, that there were not books. And as a result of that push from the bottom, from the citizenry up through the top, including the leadership of Abel Prieto, the former minister of culture, who is not an Afro descendant, but aligned himself with this question, we now see that in the context of government, these issues are being raised. But there's another important factor that has already come up in the presentation this afternoon, and that is the role of the 13 Anglophone African descent countries, both in terms of major populations and government, CARICOM. CARICOM is a part of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Integration, CELAC. And in the 2019 meeting in Mexico, all of the countries of Latin America, Cuba being among them, Brazil and others, endorsed the reparations project of CARICOM. So the question then became, how would that reflect internally in these countries, not just in their solidarity with what CARICOM was going? So the movement of citizens, the movement of black citizens in the Caribbean and their black government have really been motive forces of seeding the ground of what we're seeing in Colombia, what we're seeing in Cuba. I will be meeting with the foreign minister with others in New York in September when he's at the UN. And this is one of the issues that we will continue to discuss to see what role will they now take at the level of government with Francia Marquez and Gustavo Petro, for example, in Colombia. What role will they take with Obrador, the president of Mexico? In the last census in Mexico, over 1 million Mexicans identified themselves as Afro-Mexicans.
Incredible.
So now the reparations and identity issues progressively are busting loose all across the world and certainly in Latin America. But these are factors that surround the development coming out of Cuba.
And finally, it does appear that Lula, at the Workers' Party, is poised to recapture the presidency and the executive branch in Brazil. And I'm just wondering, certainly you and Danny have close relationships there as well and as throughout the region, but I'm just wondering, what will this mean? What do you see? What impact potentially could a Lula presidency have in the context of this growing global reparations movement?
The potential election of Lula da Silva has a huge potential to impact what is going on, not only internal to Brazil, but what is going on in the region, and actually what goes on in South-South relations. I think it's important to step back for a moment and to recall that Brazil was the last country in which enslaved Africans were liberated in 1888. So there's a developmental issue. Brazil went through this thing about it was a racial paradise and not really looking at the issues of African descendants in Brazil. What most people don't recognize is that Brazil is something like the seventh largest economy in the world. It's a leader of the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South-South relations. It is one of the most unequal countries in the world and perhaps the most unequal region of the entire world. In that context, in the last official census, people self-identifying in the census, over 50%, nearly 55% of the voters identified themselves as Black or mixed race. And the mixed race, of course, essentially comes from the African influence, although there is the indigenous influence and some Asian influence. So Brazil is fundamentally a Black country. And so that Lula, who comes from dirt poor background, some will remember when he was at Davos a decade or so ago speaking to the barons of the capitalist world, this little short guy saying, "You white men," and they were looking at this small statured white man. He was really identifying with the issues of Blackness and poverty. Lula has said that the face of poverty in Brazil is women, and significantly it's Black women. However, in that context of Lula and his Workers' Party, they have got to see the issue of race as the Black majority, as the fundamental democratic issue, as a transversal issue, not just as a ministry for Black people, but Black people have got to show up in all of the ministries. And there's a very important development that our listening audience should pay attention to and try to determine how we are going to become more in communication with this new cross-party alliance of Black people called the Black Coalition for Rights, Columbus, Quilombos to the Parliament. Quilombos are about 3,000 historically isolated Black communities of enslaved Africans. So we have this cross-grouping of parties of Black people running for official positions. And they are demanding not only to have a specific ministerial focus on Black folk, but that Black folk must become leaders of various ministries, education and health, in the interest not only of Black Brazilians, but in the interest of moving the entire country. A couple of weeks ago, I did an interview with an indigenous Black woman. Her father was indigenous. Her mother was Afro-Brazilian. She works for the landless people in Northeast Brazil, where the great majority of Afro-Brazilians live. And she was very excited about the Lula candidacy. But I asked her, what is it that they will demand of Lula? And that is that political parties work in direct collaboration with social movements. They are moving away from just electing people to government and waiting for something to be delivered to them. They're really in a posture of forcing elected officials to become stewards in active collaboration and governance and formulating policies and implementing policies with the citizenry. So in this context, Brazil will play a huge role in relationship to the CARICOM endorsement in the context of the community of Latin American and Caribbean nations, and in relationship to South-South relations. Let me just stop on this for now, because this is something that I think we have to think about overall in reparations. The largest trading partner now in South America is China. The largest trading partner with the continent of Africa now is China. We have to also take the reparations issue to all of these governments. Russia is also a big player in this, and demand that their policies also reflect the fundamental majorities in a place like Brazil, not just dealing with Euro-Brazilians. And this is one of the issues that we have to look out for. The other issue that we have to look out for, this concept of elite capture, which Olofimi Taiwo is talking about, where we have these upper middle class Black people, we've seen it in the United States and we've seen it in some other areas, assume positions of saying they speak for the Black community, and that the masses, the most impoverished people in the context of Brazil, for example, where 77% of the incarcerated people are Black, where 6 to 7 young Black men in particular are being killed every day, where LGBTQ people who are being exploited and murdered in Brazil are significantly Black and brown. So we have to see reparations as a power equation, not just for ourselves, but for moving our entire nations. And of course, in Brazil, there's the question of the indigenous community, somewhere around 1 million people who identify indigenous. And when you think about the pre-Columbian era in Brazil, in which there were over 2,000 tribes and nations in Brazil, 2 to 3 million people, they have been reduced to now just a little under 1 million people. This is the context in which Afro descent is the pivot for democracy for ourselves and material development for ourselves, but also for the uplift of our entire nations. And that also comes back to the United States as the same thing. This country is going nowhere without us, and we're going, it seems to me, nowhere in our reparatory justice movement without taking the country in a really transformative direction, including with our Native American sisters and brothers here in the United States.
Well, finally, James, again, you've done this work for a long time. You've seen different developments, different ebbs and flows that have taken place. It seems that we're at a moment of significance here. And I'm wondering, as you conclude, how would you sort of, what is your feeling about where the reparatory justice movement in relationship to the intersectionality to the other kinds of movements are? What's your feeling like, having worked on these issues for so many years?
Well, one, as I said, reparations, and you have pointed out, is busting loose all over. We see it in the U.S., state of California. We've seen it in places like Detroit. So we're going to see a lot of small gardens of reparation, if you will, flow. And I don't think that they can be stopped or that they should be interfered with. But the bigger question of reparations is at the level of state power. What is the role of the state in representing the interests of its citizens at large scale issues? So I think we have to pay attention to that dichotomy and not let it become a distraction, because people will be doing their little state things or their little city things. But we also have to look at the larger federal level. In the international context, I think we have to look at and applaud and support the role of CARICOM countries, which is, I would venture to say, the most advanced reparatory justice movement going on by way of definition of organized citizens across those 13 nations in the Caribbean, whose representatives in government are also reflecting the aspirations of these distinct groupings, whether it be Rasta, whether they be Marxists, whether they be intellectuals, but who all support reparations. And they have taken the most advanced perspective in forcing Europe to take a look at it. And so that I think we have to really, as you have been doing, and as CAM and others and NARC have been doing, and of integrating themselves and complementing the role of CARICOM in this. The last one is what I refer to as this elite capture. We have to be very careful. Some of us in the Afro-descent communities do relatively well for ourselves, but it is the masses of our sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles who have their own views of their needs that we must collaborate with in formulating these policies, not delivering policies to them, but formulating policies with them. And so those are some of the descriptive challenges that I think are before us as this movement is busting loose, because a lot of people are going to come up for different kinds of reasons under the rubric of reparations, as we have seen under the rubric of Pan-Africanism. Let's develop Pan-Africanism as a capitalist project and do business. And they're really not talking about working with organized collectives of people on the ground who are organizing their own agriculture, their own schools, and the like. So these are some of the challenges, I think, in this new moment, which has great potential. And, of course, H.R. 40, which you and NARC and CAM and others have been involved in, will play a leading role, because what happens here in the United States draws attention around the world, whether we like it or not. And we have to take advantage of this interplay between what will go on in CARICOM and places like Cuba and Brazil, and what it will force the U.S. to do, but what also goes on in the U.S., which will force them to pay attention to. These are some of the overviews, I think, from a strategic point of view, that we have to be attended to while people are actually working on the ground on concrete projects to improve the material lives and justice and the protection and security. And of course, there's the question of the environment. That is also the big macro context in which all this is taking place, because as the environment deteriorates, who does it hit first? It hits people of color.
Right. Well, James Early, thank you as always. Your analysis and your thoughtfulness and your experience bringing your lens to these issues has been incredibly helpful, and we obviously look forward to continuing to collaborate and to bring your voice back periodically and this incredibly exciting and we think meaningful moment in the history of the world, actually. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And thank you for all your work, my brother.
All right, James Early, we went a little bit over. But that was okay because James Early brings a lot to the table, as do all of our presenters and panelists that you've heard from. We're now waiting for our final panelist, who is an incredible organizer and someone who played a leading role in all of the different, at least Bellagio and Accra, the Vatican Action, and has a relationship also with the vice president in Colombia as well. So Dr. Amara Enya, we're waiting for her to join us. I don't have indication that she has done so yet, but I hope she will be because she is the closer for this the segment. Before we go to our audience, and by the way, you can get prepared. You got to walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. We'll want our audience to call and just comment and to offer your perspectives at 212-209-2881. That's 212-209-2881.
No, that's not the number. 212-209-2877.
I got it. Okay. 212-209-2877. I knew that wasn't sounding right when it was rolling off. I said, well, it doesn't sound right. 212-209-2877. But we also want you to pledge. I'm looking for 20 people who are going to join me in raising $2,000 at least in the last part of our program once we have heard from Dr. Amara Enya, who is now ready. So to close it out, I want to introduce to you Dr. Amara Enya. And as I just had already said, this amazing sister was really the glue in many respects of a lot of the work that we've been talking about, from Bellagio to Accra to the Vatican Action. And I really felt it was important to bring her on as the closer. Dr. Amara Enya, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels. Good to be here.
All right. And so, Dr. Enya, as I said before, you were the primary strategist facilitating and, you know, these different initiatives that we have put together. Our audience probably doesn't know much about Dr. Amara Enya. I hear tell that you actually ran for mayor of the city of Chicago. You have an organization called Global Black. So before we get into the details of these initiatives, would you say a word about yourself and particularly a word about Global Black?
Sure, Dr. Daniels. Yes, they're probably not well-known. I actually kind of like it that way. But my roots are in organizing in Chicago. So I live on the west side of Chicago. And so a lot of my organizing started there. I've worked in public policy primarily. I worked in government in the mayor's office in Chicago. And kind of expanded out from there. So I've done a lot of work in economic justice, public finance, education, environmental justice, pretty much all of the above. And then kind of scaled up from there. Of course, as you mentioned, I did get involved in politics and ran for mayor most recently in the 2019 election. But yeah, I have been doing a lot of work more in the international space now. My organization, Global Black, we deal with advocacy on issues of concern to Black people around the world. So we're deeply involved in some of the policy areas that I mentioned, but also really just trying to build bridges and draw linkages between and amongst us wherever we find ourselves, and to recognize the role of these global systems and why it's so important that we are aware of each other, so that we can create collective strategies that help us or that move us toward liberation. So that's pretty much the goal in a nutshell.
Right. And I must say, in the middle of all the work that you were doing, you were graduating from the London School of Economics with distinction and had to gather your family, had a great celebration and all that. So, again, I'm going to bring you back. I have this series called The Phenomenal Black Women, so I'm going to call you back for an in-depth piece later on. But, again, incredible
Absolutely.
Work. So I want you
Thank
to just
you.
Want you to reflect, because you really were the glue. I mean, you really were the person helping us to strategize, to facilitate, to think through, you know, how to do things substantively, politically, and all of these ways. And so it was Bellagio. We've talked about Bellagio. We talked about the Vatican Act. We talked about Accra, and we'll talk about that even more. But I want to just in terms of the work that you've done, and of course, James already talked about this as well. So how do you feel about these amazing gatherings? What is your sense of where we are?
Well, I mean, I would definitely say, first and foremost, just the caliber of people that were able to come together, I think, is really what made just the all of these initiatives so successful. I mean, you have so many folks that came from around the world who are just brilliant in their thinking, who've been thinking through these issues, working toward active in these issues, particularly around reparations and justice broadly. So it was, for me, it was a real pleasure to get to work with everyone in a particular way where they were bringing all of that to the table for this common cause of advancing this reparations work. And so that was really exciting. I feel energized because I do think that we're at a different stage of the work. I mean, and Dr. Daniels, you know probably better than most of us what this work was like years ago when it was seen as fringe or it was seen as a marginal
Absolutely.
Issue or just, you know, some kind of pie in the sky type of thing. And you can kind of see the transformation, how the discourse has changed around it. And then to see people coming together to develop actual action plans, strategies that can be implemented at the global level, the national level, the local level, it's really amazing. And that's something that I don't take for granted at all. And it's energizing for me because I know, you know, you mentioned politics and I was one of those people who people used to say, I mean, you have so many ideas, you know, no one cares about ideas. You have, you know, it's almost like when something that seems impossible, it's so easy for people to write it off. And so it's incredibly satisfying to see the work, the progress that's happening in real time and to be a part of it.
Right. Now the Vatican action, I, you know, I mean, this Vatican action was something else, so to speak. It was just, and it opens up a whole new space. So I just have to, Cam commented on it too, but I just have to ask you as well, because I know you were collaborating with Cam. We all were, but you were working very closely with him, helping to shape it and to develop the strategy and to, you know, and to work it out. So, and then to just to end up in that meeting with the secretary of the Pontificate Council on Culture, which is where the apology toward the Pope is doing is live. So that is the place where the reparations discussion is taking place. I mean, so give us your sense of what that was like.
Well, it was really incredible. I think, you know, I would say it kind of exceeded expectations, and you're absolutely right in the sense of being in this institution, which had such a critical role in the advancement of the transatlantic slave trade, and being able to have the presentment that Cam and Dr. Enola really took the lead on drafting, that lays out the harms, that lays out the remedies, that lays out a plan for how we can work together on what repair looks like, and to be able to present it and get their response in real time. And the response was one of acknowledgement. And it was also a candid conversation about what it would look like, what it takes to actually move from this position of, you know, here's where we are. Here's what we know of your institution and what is your response and plan to meet us in this process of developing what repair and remedy looks like. And so it was really, again, I think it was a really groundbreaking moment. It's not to say that there hasn't been work or perhaps discussion around the role of the Roman Catholic Church in reparations, but to actually be there at the Vatican, to be clear-minded and to make a strong presentment that lays out the case, and to have that initial agreement and acknowledgement and a conversation that says, yes, we acknowledge. Now, the timeline was, you know, a little bit long for us, of course, but
yes.
for them to say, yes, we acknowledge this, and here is to begin to walk down that path, I think is really groundbreaking.
Right. Well, the connection between Bellagio and the Vatican action, and of course all of this fed into the Accra summit, and what an amazing gathering! What an amazing gathering that was, and all of the thinking, all of the thought that went into it. There is a Accra declaration about to come out. And so I'm wondering whether you would kind of preview that in terms of some of the major kind of takeaways that came out of all of this energy and effort that was advanced. What are some of the major takeaways that you see? What can our audience expect in terms of this Accra Declaration, and when will it be released?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to draw the through line between the gathering of Bellagio, which really was an opportunity for so much learning and understanding, for folks to come together from around the world to really learn and to get to deepen our knowledge of the issue, the level of, you know, we're bringing so-called experts, but the level of humility that everyone exhibited and the desire to learn, I think, should be noted. And so coming out of that, we had 15 takeaways, and Dr. Daniels, you're a major part of those takeaways from the days that we were together just brainstorming and thinking and dialoguing. And then that led to, from there, the Vatican action, which recognized, one, the role of Western institutions and mm-hmm. colonial entities and the Roman Catholic Church in the transatlantic slave trade, and really thinking through, this isn't just about the past, this is about the future, right? And so taking that conversation and taking some of those learnings to the Vatican after we left Bellagio, and then finally culminating in the convening in Accra, which again was really focused on from the Black perspective in the Black world and building bridges, where we had Black people coming from around the world to develop collective strategy to dive deeper into these issues. And what does the road look like moving forward? So it's important that we weren't just there to chat amongst ourselves. We were there to sharpen our analysis and to develop a strategy for moving forward, which the global reparations movement can implement. And that is what came out in the form of this declaration that will be released this week, actually on Wednesday officially, which is the International Day for People of African Descent. That day was designated a couple of years ago by the United Nations. And so we thought it appropriate to release this declaration that charts the path forward for the global reparations movement. It highlights comments by the president of Ghana, His Excellency Nana Akufo-Addo, who really made an unequivocal statement that global reparations is an imperative. And this is significant because it's a sitting head of state on the continent, which sends a very strong message to leadership throughout the continent about the importance of this conversation, not as simply a reflection on the past, but on the way forward for a self-determining people everywhere on the continent, and the importance of bridging the gaps and building bridges between the continent and the diaspora, people of African descent around the world. And so the declaration lays that out. It puts out specific calls, you know, what we need to do, convening ourselves, reparations commissions coming together to develop clear strategies. How do we determine ourselves, the concept of global African? What can the new permanent form on people of African descent do to convene these colonial entities, and what needs to happen in that regard for an assessment of what repair looks like? All of this is embodied in this declaration, which builds on the 1993 Abuja Proclamation, which was a previous convening on reparations. And it also builds on the 2001 Durban Declaration and Program of Action, which is perhaps one of the, if not the most significant document that sort of outlines when we talk about racism and discrimination and all of its legacies. And so it builds on that with a way forward. And so it's going to be released this week on Wednesday, which is the International Day of People of African Descent. And we hope that it can serve as a clear and cogent organizing tool for people wherever they find themselves to begin to move on one accord and to move cohesively as much as possible in this reparations work.
Well, it is an incredible document. The whole process has been incredible. Your role in it has been incredible. I guess I would ask, is there a space and place that people will be able to view or to gather the press release, but of course the declaration itself? I'm sure we're going to post it on the IBW and NARC websites, but are there other places and spaces that you would suggest that people go to in order to view the ACOA declaration?
Yes, so many of the organizations and the individuals representing organizations that convened in ACOA will have the declaration. It'll also be translated into other languages, in Spanish and French. So they will also have it on their website. So, for example, the Africa Transitional Justice Legacy Fund will have it on their site and others. And we have the Global Circle website that's actually in development now. And the declaration, the communique, all of those materials that came out of the last several months of work will be housed on that website as well. So we're hoping that it's centralized in our website, but for all of the organizations that participated, they also will hold the declaration, the communique, on their websites as well, so that it can be shared as broadly as possible, including, as you mentioned, IBW.
Well, the other thing I think is important as we conclude, Dr. Inya, is to, you referenced the Abuja Proclamation and the Durban Declaration, because I think it's important for people to understand the ebb and flow of history. I was talking about that with Dr. Garvey. I talked about that with James Early. These things sometimes take centuries. And certainly you recall Professor Beckel's presentation, which he talked about, I forget, did he say seven waves? I forget what those waves are of how, how in over 300 years and how this has taken. But it is ripening at a certain moment. And these events and the roles that people have played have taken us to this point. So I think it's a celebratory moment. It doesn't mean that it's over. It means a lucha continua. It means we have to intensify the struggle. But it is exhilarating and gratifying that every now and then, against almost insurmountable odds, the improbable becomes the probable, the impossible becomes possible because of the collective work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer in taking some time, even if just a moment, to acknowledge the wins and to acknowledge the progress, because it really is, I mean, it's hard won, right? And you're absolutely right in the notion of acknowledging the work and the history behind it, because nothing that we're doing started at this point that we're in. Nothing that we're involved with just materialized at this point. It was the hard work of people generations before, particularly around the separations work, that is culminating in this moment that we find ourselves now. And so I feel like it's our responsibility to acknowledge the history and the work that went in before, because that's what we're building on, and to acknowledge those wins and that progress, because we are at a moment that is unprecedented, and that is a product of your commitment. All of the folks who have gathered even this year, but those who, you know, even like yourself, who have just been carrying the work, even when there was no, you know, sometimes you can't really see much happening. You can't see, you know, the progress, but continue to carry it. And I feel like myself and so many others are just grateful that you have been diligent in stewarding this work, because it allows us to now continue and to push as hard as we can to move things forward.
Dr. Amara Inya, who was a strategist for the Global Circle for Reparations and Healing, her own organization, Global Black, and she is doing very, very serious work all around the country, all around the world, and we are delighted that you played the role that you played, and obviously we will continue to do this work together. Thank you so much for sharing time with us this afternoon on this special edition of Vantage Point.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right, to our listening audience, we're going to transition. We're running a little behind. I was hoping to have, 25 minutes in order to do messages from the audience and also to raise these dollars. But it can be done. Actually, it can be done. I'm putting up a pledge of $100 right now. I don't want to be braggadocious. I'm not don't want to be hyperbolic. What you have heard in the last hour and a half is utterly extraordinary. Extraordinary. And you heard it where? On WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network. You are not likely to hear this kind of quality programming around one of the most important and significant movements in the world today. You're not going to hear it anywhere other than on WBAI or the Pacifica Network. And so that is a gift. That is what, again, I go back to Professor James Small. He talked about the fortress of resistance and transformation. That's what we do here on WBAI. And by the way, let me just say parenthetically, some of you remember, one of the persons that we came and hung out with us in Accra was Esther Armand. She actually came and met with us and so forth. And you remember she used to be on the morning show back in the day, so forth and so on. But that, I mean, there were people who just gathered, if you will. So I'm asking people to join me and call right now. I mean, just call right now. Pick up your phone. You can walk and chew bubblegum too, because I want to also hear from as many people as possible with quick comments. But call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And say, I'm calling. I love the program. I learned from the program. I want to match the professor's pledge of $100. Do that right now, please. Please. Go to your phones right now. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I want 20 people. I need 20 people at least. That'll mean we're going to raise $2,100 because I want you to match my $100. So I need 20 people. I need 20 people. And you're there. You're listening. You heard some spectacularly important, amazing information from some of the most amazing reparations leaders in the world right here on WBAI on the special edition that dealt with and is dealing with the global updates on the global reparations movement. And when I asked the program director, she quickly said, yes, go right ahead, do it. And I said, well, I'm also going to add to it because I know the station needs the resources, a component that will have us deal with raising some funds. 212-209-2950. Go to your phones right now. I just want to have that confidence. I mean, you look at all the struggles. What is going on in Colombia? All of the brutality and the viciousness, and yet they have prevailed. They prevailed. I mean, it ain't over. And the brutality that is still going on all around the resistance to this movement, but we are winning. We are winning. And we're not asking you to go to the front lines and to carry a rifle or to do anything along those lines. We're just asking you to contribute because this information is power. You will be able to connect with Reparations United. You will be able to go to the IBW website and look at both the presentment and also the Accra Declaration by going to IBW21.org. Or Cam talked about the fact if you want to get involved in the Accra action, you can go to cam@reparationsunited.org. Dr. Jordi Grill gave her two organizations out. Her new book is coming out. Ooh, what a fabulous program. Today, if I have to say so myself, I'm going to say it. I loved it. I was excited about it. 212-209-2950. We just need, and I mean, just blow it up right quick. We need to get past this. Just give me, please, just have 20 people call right now. 212-209-2950. Thank you. I hear some people are calling, and we need that. Blow it up. Volunteers are there at our center to receive your donations. 212-209-2950. The show is Vantage Point. The host is the professor. You say that there's no premium. There's no premium. This is the premium. The show was the premium. And we hope that you'll call in now. Let's see, can we get some callers in, however, for the next 10 minutes as we go off the air? Anyone who want to call and just give a comment, if you have to donate first and call, that'd be fine. If not, you just want to call, that'll be fine too. You can donate later. Or maybe you want it all, because there's no prohibition. Everybody can't afford it, and we don't block people because they don't have resources. So 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. If you'd like to call and give us a quick comment, what you heard today, its significance, how did it make you feel, suggestions, recommendations, you're certainly welcome to do so. I see we have a caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Daniels. Smatum, Philly, New Jersey. And I understand that you have some time restraints, and I'm very sad about that, because when issues like this are raised in an area like this, people all over the world want to talk about it. And I just really, really get sad when there's not enough time, you know, to raise something like this and give the real insight on that you want to give as a caller. I know that I don't
But my brother, rather than lament, give us your insight, because we certainly heard a lot of brilliant insights. So if you have some additional insights, please do it, and do it quickly, and then we'll move on to the next caller. There'll be other opportunities. So go right ahead.
Can you let me know when you're getting ready to cut me off? I'm gonna give you a minute.
You don't have time for a dissertation. You have a minute, and then because these are quick hits. I mean, what we did was lay a base of information for 90 minutes with some of the brightest and best we have in the African world. I would put them up against anybody. So if you have a quick comment, if you have an additional idea, just give us your idea.
The thing that they're talking about, Afro, that doesn't exist. There's no country or continent called Afro, and that needs to end. The whole thing about global international reparations, it's good, but we need to get some reparations in the United States first.
Well, we're doing that on H.R. 40. That's what H.R. 40 is all about. If you listen to the work that we're doing, H.R. 40 is about reparations in the United States of America, but it is a pan-Africanist movement. It is a global movement. There's a synergy between what happens in the United States, in the Caribbean, in Brazil, in Colombia, and in Africa. It's not an isolated movement, nor are we confining reparations to only black people in America. So that's not happening. That's not where this movement is going, and it has overwhelming support of people around the world. So we can discuss that perspective in more detail later. Let me move on to another caller. Again, the number is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We have an opportunity for another few callers to join if you would like to. I understand the lines are wide open. You can call right now. But again, we don't have time for you to call and do. We got 10 minutes, 9 minutes. So if you give us a quick comment, a quick observation, we would appreciate it. And the other side of it is walking and chewing bubblegum at the same time. Contributions of $100 are welcome or less. Give what you can. If you can give $15, $20, $50, whatever you can give, but $100 makes it easy. If you get 20 people at $100 matching my pledge of $100, that will give resources to the station instantly. But we'll take whatever contribution you have. You can do it by credit card, by debit card. You can make an arrangement to play it by check, whatever. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Match my contribution or do whatever you can in the next few minutes. Let's see, can we squeeze in another caller? Let's see whether we have any callers at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. The lines are wide open if anyone would care to listen. I know a lot of times people like to listen and just hear, but we do like to open our phones up for people to make their contributions and to give their ideas and sometimes it's just good to say you enjoyed the program, you know, you learned from the program. And again, this is not the last time, however, that we'll be talking about reparations. Obviously, it's one of the key issues that I work on with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. I spent much of my life working on it. And so, therefore, this is not the last time. But this is an incredible moment. Incredible moment. And again, very often the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. Sometimes the best way to curse the darkness is to shine a light. Sometimes we have to be a little more optimistic and claim victory. Claim victory. We are winning. Let's go to another caller quickly. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Yeah, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
I can't hear you. Speak right up. Yes, sure. You're short on time, but go right ahead.
All right. Can you hear me? Listen, I can hear you.
Turn your radio down and speak just directly to us. Come right ahead.
Okay. Well, I just want to thank really both of you and all of the wisdom that you guys shared with us today about reparations and the global reparations movement, H.R. 40 and the like. I'm actually here with my daughter and her friend and classmate. And, you know, I'm wondering, with them being 16, what can they do as high schoolers to support the reparations, global reparations movement? I want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think education becomes important, and as they educate themselves, they can become involved at the state level in helping to organize with people. If you're in, for example, if you're in the state of New Jersey, there's an effort in New Jersey to create a New Jersey task force on reparations. The same thing is happening in other places like Maryland and whatever. But the first thing is the education, and in that regard, I would go to the IBW website, IBW21.org. I would begin with the National African American Reparations 10-Point Reparations Program. The National African American Reparations 10-Point Reparations Program. Learn about it. In addition to that, if you're from New Jersey, I'm sure we have information about how you can connect with the Say the Word campaign for reparations in the state of New Jersey, if that's where you're calling from. In New York, also, there's a major effort to create a reparations task force here in the city of in the state of New York as well. And so as they learn about it, then they can connect to those efforts and actually become engaged. And I'm so excited that they indeed are. You had them listen in. That's the way it should work. You may be knowledgeable, but bring that next generation of listeners and potential activists on board as well. So thank you so much for listening in. Okay, well, I don't know if we have one more. We can squeeze one more. 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute. But let me just quickly make another pitch. Please go to your phone. Please.
All right,
please.
One more.
Okay, we got one more. Okay, good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes. Hello, Dr. Daniels. This is Sister Adelia from Detroit.
Yes.
And I just wanted to let you know that that was a historical continent talk that you had today. And the content is definitely being sent around my network.
Great.
As the social media maven since 2016 for reparations now, I am still posting my own version of reparations, the H.R. 40, passed the H.R. 40 bill. And I'm very happy that you guys are moving and shaking through to some of these larger foundations and securing your funds to continue to move forward. And you've earned it, I'm sure. You've been on this passed for 20, 30, 40 years, and so it's time to get something compensatory for all of your efforts. But don't forget about these next gens. I'm kind of in between the next gen and the generation right before the next gen.
Yeah, but we're going to work together.
We're out here with our tech background and our creative background, and we have plans to do development as we get our reparations, you know, us development type.
Y'all are on the move in Detroit, and we're looking forward to connecting with you. I know that, I don't know.
Right.
I know,
well, I have pushed the Detroit.
I sure you did. But look, I got to run. That music in the background, Fight the Power, means I have to get off the air, or I have to fight the power at WBAI. But thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. This is the Professor. We thank you for tuning in to this special update on the reparations, global reparations movement. And again, we'll see you next week here on Vantage Point.